You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse.
Welcome to Bruderhof Radio. We're broadening the bounds of discourse on progressive thought and action. I'm your host, Andrew Zimmerman.
To me, it's perfectly obvious that what we're doing is fostering a kind of pathological dependency, that we're not making students self-confident to sort of build the internal resources that they need as learners, as active inquirers, as shapers of the world that they are going to live in.
Stanley Kubrick's landmark film, 2001: A Space Odyssey, first hit theaters in 1968. At the time, most Americans were as yet unfamiliar with the concept of computers, and the year 2001, now just around the corner, must have seemed light years away. Nevertheless, the film created an immediate sensation and led many to question man's relationship to technology, in particular the creation of artificial intelligence using computers. Kubrick's creation, the supercomputer named HAL that competed with humans for control of his spacecraft, was to be reincarnated many times in the world of science fiction. America, it seemed, had contracted a healthy case of technophobia. Not so today. In the last decade, the high-tech industry has flooded our lives with faster, more affordable, and more attractive electronic and computerized devices. We buy them, we sell them, we install them in our homes, our cars, and yes, even our schools. This week, in the first part of Bruderhof Radio's two-part series on education, a look at America's infatuation with all things high-tech, and how this affects the education of our children. We spoke first with Langdon Winner, professor of political science at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York, and author of several articles about society and technology. I'd like to start by asking you a question that you posed to the readers of, I think it was Newsday, and you asked the readers exactly how and when are computers distinctly useful as compared to other tools of learning, and what's your answer to that?
Well, my answer really is that in this day and age, we tend to go to the computer first and for just about every purpose. The point of the question is to return us to the basic questions about ends and purposes. And once one's become clear about that, then you can think about which instruments are truly useful. One thing that I find disturbing about the current push for computers in education and distance learning, for example, is that this enterprise has very little sense of what the ends of education are, what the purposes of teaching and learning are all about. There are no new philosophies of education which have arisen in this new enterprise. Secondly, there's no consistent or coherent address to the question of what educational strategies make sense, and there's a tendency to set aside what everybody has known for a very long time, namely that in education, the best single element are the encounters that students have with knowledgeable and inspired teachers. People able to open worlds of knowledge in art and science and music and literature, social studies, engineering, whatever the field. And instead, there is these days to sort of put the cart before the horse, the instrument before the purpose, and to say, oh, computers, network computers are a kind of big magic, so we'll just start there.
Are you skeptical merely about the misuse or overuse of technology in schools, or are you skeptical in some ways about the technology itself? In other words, are you sort of a neo-Luddite, or you just have concerns about how this technology is being applied?
Well, I'm very much interested in people who use information machines creatively in their work. I know a lot of artists and composers and scientists, engineers, and social scientists. They tend to be older and well along in their work, and they have learned somewhere the fundamentals, the basic orientation toward the world and toward the world of the knowledge that they're working within. What bothers me is the idea that educational technologies, including the computer, are a substitute for these fundamentals. There's a good deal of research that really goes back to the 1920s, which has produced a principle about educational technology. The principle is that of no significant difference. So decade after decade, where people have looked at the use of movies, of tape recorders, of television, of personal computers, network computers, all kinds of educational technologies which have been introduced since the time of Thomas Edison and his movie machine. The research has been pretty consistent, which is that it doesn't matter which technologies you use to convey information, there's no significant difference in how much students learn. Now, for the educational proponents, I suppose, this is good news, and maybe for the rest of it, it's pretty good news, because it suggests that whether using video cassettes or movies or personal computers or network computers, perhaps you're not doing too much harm, because it may, in study after study, it's shown that people who use no technology, or those who use package of technology A or package of technology B, the learning for some students is better in some cases and worse in others. But by and large, the measurements show that it doesn't much matter what kind of technology is used.
Now, you mentioned a number of studies that show that technology doesn't really improve the quality of education or give people a better education. Have there been any studies shown, or do you know of any examples where the use of technology has really hurt or hindered an education? I don't mean just in the fact that the money is being diverted from arts or music, as you mentioned before, but where the actual use of technology maybe stifles creativity or makes students less able to think creatively.
Well, I don't. I can't put my hand on studies at this moment. Among educators that I know who work closely with children, however, there are a great many who would say that given what the computer does, these very powerful, expensive machines, if you ask, let's say, grade school students, or even junior high students, middle school students, to look at their learning in reading, writing, mathematics, scientific inquiry, and other basic subjects as something that depends upon the use of high-powered information machines, what you're actually doing is insulting the ability of the students. What it says, in effect, is, well, you're not capable of having these resources internally. What you're going to need are these external resources, these powerful information machines. And I think what this does, and regardless of what any studies show, to me it's perfectly obvious that what we're doing is fostering a kind of pathological dependency, that we're not making students self-confident to sort of build the internal resources that they need as learners, as active inquirers, as shapers of the world that they are going to live in. Instead, we're creating highly dependent functionaries in a global economy. And I don't know why that idea is so appealing to people.
Now, some will argue that you need a certain level of computer literacy just to survive in the so-called information age. How do you balance these two? How do you provide this technical proficiency without stifling creativity?
Well, I think what one has to do is just draw reasonable boundaries. If one is, let's say, studying biology, one ought to have access to biological specimens and to teachers who care about biology, and not immediately rush to, you know, a CD-ROM that has, you know, lessons and pictures and so forth of living things. I think that in our time, information machines have become a part of social life, a part of the workplace. What's problematic is the substitution for these machines for other domains of experience, other domains of knowledge and practice. So I'm not opposed to the use of information machines. What I oppose is the woeful insertion of them prematurely into education and various kinds of contemporary practice.
Are we ever going to get to the point where the computer can just be another tool, maybe like a calculator or a pen and paper, where, you know, people aren't so infatuated by this new digital thing?
Well, that's a good question. I think that, that in many ways that's the question of our civilization right now. Will we overcome the fixation, the obsession with technique, with instrumentality, of which the computer is simply the most exquisite manifestation? I think what's happened in Western civilization is that the attention to, you know, how we make this instrument work better, how do we improve this process, how do we improve this method, has become, you know, the kind of central fixation, such that we never go back to ask, you know, what are we about? You know, what should we be doing here? You know, we're always just tinkering with the machinery. And that blinds us to more fundamental questions about human relationships, about the natural realm, about questions of government, law, freedom, justice. We're always just tinkering with the mechanism and always looking for new ideas and vitality and energy to come from that. Then I think you have a whole civilization which is fundamentally adrift. And I hope that someday there'll be a widespread awakening to the fact that we've become hideously overcommitted to instrumentality, right to the basic core of our way of life.
Todd Allen Price recently completed his doctorate at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, where he studied the role of computers and technology in education. His thoughts closely parallel those of Professor Winner.
Well, initially, the issue of public education, first of all, is to serve a greater good, which is hard to value in the marketplace. It's really for citizenship building and for preparing a younger generation of individuals to take on a greater role in a democratic society. So that would be where I would start. And then the place where computers and instructional technology enters that picture is where that enhances the initial mission of the public education institution, or if there are other avenues in which the educational technology and the computer are intended to serve. Now, the computers are merely a tool, and as such, they are basically, as any other tool, any other educational technology tool, for example, radio, television, overheads, microfiche, things of that sort, they are just there to enhance the instruction and to supplement the curriculum in meaningful ways if they're to accomplish anything at all.
Unless you're a Luddite, it's hard to argue that technology has no place in the classroom. But when computers become the focus of an educational philosophy, rather than a supplement to it, Price says the student suffers from a narrowing of perspective.
Now, in the public schools, what does this mean? Does it mean that Johnny or Jane are being given a curriculum that discourages creativity and innovation? Again, in the short term, I would say largely yes. I would say that what we are seeing is that there is just not much time afforded for one of the critical, very, very critical components of a democratic education, and what I would say is a critical education, and that is deliberation. There is what I see at the same time a narrowing of the curriculum. There is also a speeding up of the time in which people are given, and I mean people by not only young students but adult students in college and continuing students. There's an increasingly short amount of time given to deliberate, to basically consider and to weigh and to examine the different types of knowledges that are out there. So the liberal arts is something I've laid out some fairly lofty ideas, but putting it in perspective, the liberal arts in a given public school or in a public university, a state land grant university like a University of Wisconsin, for example, has historically played a tremendously important role. Perhaps I would say a primary role, because liberal arts education is that which makes the individual more caring, more concerned about social justice, more involved in the issues of the day in a meaningful way, and not in a way which accepts the given order. But a liberal arts education is one which equips the individual with thoughts, ideas, but also a sense of purpose and a certain progressivity, where you don't accept the social order, you don't accept the conditions as such. You are always critical in the sense that you are looking at how the world could be a better place, and you're rarely accepting the world as it is, as a fait accompli or a finished product. That is vastly out of line with the thinking in the schools today, and that's why I would say the liberal arts hold so little sway over the current climate of the public schools.
But as more and more schools buy into what Price calls the technological myth, only a very few are daring to ask just how all this technology affects the students themselves. Heinrich Arnold is a middle school teacher in upstate New York. His school has drastically reduced the role of computers in their curriculum.
Well, in the Woodcrest School, where I've been teaching for the past 8 years, up to 2 years ago, we'd pretty much kept up with the times as far as advancing our technologies and buying computers and software. And we bought a lot of the educational software. Of course, there's grant money available to schools to purchase software. So we used it in science. We used it in teaching keyboarding, in history, in math, in reading. And we also used it a lot for... We thought it was creative at that time to generate papers and titles and pictures, and we also did quite a bit of research on it. Like when kids would do research on different subjects, instead of going to the library, it was quite easy to look on one of the search engines for the material you were looking for. We started to realize that what we were teaching our children, our students, by relying so heavily on computers was kind of an easy way out, a lazy attitude. It was very difficult for students to learn how to use indexes, to learn how to use the library, and also we were seeing a decrease in creativity in drawing and writing. And so that is the underlying reason why we decided to scale back so drastically.
Critics say Arnold and his colleagues may be doing their students a disservice by isolating them from technology they will need to use later in life. But Arnold disagrees.
I grew up, going to school 20 years ago, computers weren't a mainstay in the classroom, and a lot of people my age who are now computer geniuses didn't have that computer education in grade school or even high school. They got that later in college or on the job, and they're doing just fine. And I think it's much more important to develop active thinking skills and creative skills, and computer skills can be learned later on as they are needed. If we start out with a computer skill, it seemed that there was a deadening effect on students' minds and their creativity and their ability just to do common sense, down-to-earth work. That seemed to be slipping, and I think that's a general trend in the country. we need to get back to basics. And it really is a more of an active lifestyle, a more active education system, whereas I think if you have more and more technologies, it's more passive. It's more sit back, look, listen. And I think it generates a very passive attitude in people and inability to have initiative, to have creativity. I wouldn't say that as a blanket statement, but I definitely see those trends in our society as well, and I think a lot of that has to do with technology and the fast pace of media. And I think it also is a reflection of the whole media of our country. Everything has become more glitzy, glamorous, fast-paced, little sound bites and video clips.
Arnold says that rather than suffering from this drastic change, his students supported the reduction in classroom computing.
I was surprised how positively the students took to this. Of course, we made an attempt to make it positive. You know, we said we'd have more time to have fun, to get outdoors. We'd be more creative about what we were doing. And we sort of laid it out like a challenge. And our students have really rose to that occasion. We see that most in a journal that we started up this year that we came up with this title, Log Offline. And that is a totally handwritten journal about school events and community events. And it's been an exciting project, and that's where we see a lot of the creativity that's coming from this decision. The students have to write by hand their articles, their interviews, and then we have to make the suggestions. They have to recopy it through several stages and finally make a nice copy, neatly handwritten in the right format. You can't just click and drag and cut and chop and paste, so it's a little bit more work.
To get a better idea of the journal with the tongue-in-cheek name, we spoke to three of the students involved with Log Offline. Jared Domer, Dory Rhodes, and Trevor Weiser are 7th and 8th grade students in Arnold's class.
It's all written out by hand, which, again, makes it a lot more work. It's also a lot more creative. I mean, anyone can get on a computer and paste and cut and stuff, and it's not original artwork. They didn't do it themselves. And it's also more pleasing to the eye. We thought that people would enjoy it more if it was handwritten, and then they could acknowledge all the work that was put into it.
Before we started the magazine, we had gotten rid of computers, so we knew it would be different. We knew we'd have to write it out by hand, and that would look different. And we also were trying to think about a lot of new columns that would be interesting, not just like little recipes.
When we started the magazine, we cut a lot back on our normal classes to fit in each issue, and it covers a lot of them, like writing and how to write reports, and so I think that was a pretty good idea.
The magazine also gives us more opportunities to learn about real history, more than just what the textbooks would tell us. I did an article about Columbus, and doing research for it, I was very shocked at comparing what the textbooks would tell me and what I found in books from Howard Zinn and from diaries of people who went with Columbus.
I guess that all you 7th and 8th graders my age can, sure, you can spend a lot of time on the internet, but if you make a magazine like this, it's something that's really gonna stay with you, because you'll forget the stuff that you learn on the internet pretty easily. And a lot of this stuff is other people's opinions and what they're telling you.
It is ironic that in the age of the so-called information superhighway, technology can actually become a conduit for the wrong information. But what students often don't realize, according to Todd Price, is how they are being used by the global corporate structure that controls their access to this technology. And this, at least for Price, is perhaps more troubling even than the loss of individuality and creativity.
Ultimately, what's driving all of the corporations is a bottom line, which is to make the next quarter. And what it amounts to is a situation where we are looking at the globalization of the world in terms of economic markets being opened up that were otherwise fairly regulated. This whole structure is being broken down by the globalization. And the telecommunications corporations in particular, like an Ameritech, are part and parcel of this globalization effort. what do these corporations want to do in the schools then is they want to have freer access to the schools. They're interested in developing a really a class of students that will enter the workforce, as many corporations have called it, ready to learn. Now what they mean by that is that the corporations really want their cake and they want to eat it too. They would like for the students to be largely trained as opposed to educated. They would like a lot of the students trained in order to be up to speed on the latest applications that the corporation is using, such that a given telecommunications corporation or most every industry that is moving into the computers right now will not have to spend money to train those individuals. And thus, the public education institution is seen as a breeding ground for future employees. It's a breeding ground for students that are expected to come ready to learn as soon as they hit the sticks and come out of high school. And thus, the best way to ensure and to determine that those students are going to be ready to enter those jobs is by ensuring that the curriculum reflects that world that the telecommunications companies and the corporations are largely determining. That means a globalized new world order, where the students are really not encouraged to be free thinkers or philosophers. That's really the last thing that the corporations want.
Todd Price of the University of Wisconsin has studied the relationship between high-tech corporations and the schools who use their products. He says that while offers of free technology from companies like telecommunications giant Ameritech may seem tempting to school administrators, students and school districts often pay a heavy price in other ways.
Up until this point, we've talked about various ideals and nonetheless important ideals, but where it hits the road is where an Ameritech comes into, for example, a school district, and this is the proposal they make for them. They have done this in Milwaukee and Columbus and in Appalachian region in southeastern Ohio, in Indianapolis, and elsewhere. And what they have proposed to the school districts is this: we will wire your schools largely for free if indeed you and others lobby for deregulation of our market. That's what they did in 1993 and 1994, and they proposed this not just to the schools, whose purpose, of course, could only be to lobby. Schools don't make the laws. But they suggested this to other citizens and other groups, and they talked to legislators, and they spent millions of dollars to lobby the legislators and explain to them, listen, this ultimately is about the children. This is about the schools. We want the schools and children in those schools to have the best of the world. We want them to be able to, at the click of the mouse or at their very fingertips, to be able to access the wealth and the knowledge of the world. And this is how they sold it. And a lot of schools, well, as such, are very interested in knowledge, and they're very interested in data, for that matter. They're interested in systems that can readily discern and transmit and distribute data and information and hopefully knowledge too, because there's some differences between data and knowledge. But nonetheless, the schools were able to get onto that bandwagon. So various schools in Wisconsin, these were called super schools. They took on several of the Ameritech applications, one of those being a Dynex library learning system, a system that would replace the card catalog, a homework hotline, where a student that didn't attend school that day or a parent that would like to know what their student is to be learning could dial in and get the day's homework assignment. Or they had also compressed video and some ability to have some networks distributed between schools so teachers could video conference via a compressed video network. But the granddaddy of all of this was the video distance learning application, a large 53-inch screen monitor as located in two sister sites, and these sites would share classes over the network. So you would have like a Highmount Elementary in inner city Milwaukee hooked up to one of the other elementary schools and teaching, for example, a lesson on music appreciation. Or at times there would be attempts to visit different institutions, as is the case in Indianapolis, where schools are able to visit the museum or the zoo and are able to visit a theater. These are some of the ways in which the networks, and in particular a video distance learning application, which is ultimately two-way television, full motion, interactive, audio and video going both ways. This is how it was done. It was built in the sense of this is going to open the classroom and break down the walls of the traditional classroom. And it, wouldn't it be fun? And some of it is very fun and entertaining. And indeed, these electronic field trips are in some sense, the means by which inner-city youth in an Indianapolis or a Columbus or Milwaukee, which are in some ways fairly segregated communities. Milwaukee is probably the most segregated community in the United States. This is a way that some of the poor African-American children can be able to get out of the school, if not physically so, but can get out of the school and see some things and experience some things and hear from some people that they would otherwise not be able to hear, see, or experience. And this was very appealing, and many people bought into the idea of super schools. The problem with it is that it was largely a sham. Super schools was a slogan system. There was never a real super school, but there was a display called super schools that was availed to interested educators to use in their classroom at a price. That price being that the site, the origination site where the signal was distributed or where a teacher could send out a class or deliver curriculum and pedagogy over the interactive television, well, that site would be made available for various businesses to come in and see how this video distance learning worked. In fact, Ameritech is fairly well aware of this quid pro quo, and fairly not only aware of it, but they tend not to mince words too much about it. They were basically selling this idea and this notion such that they could really demonstrate to the business community the efficacy of video distance learning, or in the business community what's called teleconferencing. So the schools were largely used for one reason, for many reasons, but the first reason being, the most important reason, to foment telecommunications deregulation. Now, the telecommunications deregulation, which the school leaders and various individuals from all walks of life that thought that wiring the schools was the next best thing since sliced bread, they lobbied largely in the interests, if not wittingly, for the Ameritechs and for the local exchange carriers that wanted to get these phone networks up to the schools and make a big profit on it. And so the schools were used that way and used very effectively. And Ameritech has since become, it's hard to keep track. Now, the last I heard, they're a $53 billion firm where they were an $11 billion firm in 1994. They recently partnered with SBC. So now that is the fourth largest merger in corporate history. Ameritech has done exceeded beyond what they could have imagined. They have entered the new century, and will be entering the new century, a larger corporation than most nations of the world, having more assets than most nations in the world. So it served, super schools has certainly gone a long way to help them out there. Now, in the second sense, what this has resulted in is that the school classroom is no longer a sacred place. And that may, in fact, seem to be a little idyllic, and that may seem to be a little romantic about the public school classroom. Individuals might very well argue, well, that's silly. There's always been business people in school classrooms. There's always been various types of business messages, and there's been business partnerships with schools. What gives? Why is Ameritech or any of these other companies like Microsoft or Disney or Viacom or TCI any different? What's different? Well, I would agree. It's not much different. It's just it's quantitatively different, the scale and the scope, which is that whereas in the past you may indeed have had business partnerships with the schools, and you may have had raffles and school bake sales, and you may have had various semi-public-private relationships in order to maintain the efficacy of a public school for the community. Usually it was a little bit less interested. It was fairly disinterested, in fact, with what the various businesses were actually selling. It would seem a little bit rude or a little bit obnoxious for a business person to come into a public school classroom and use that as a venue for selling the kids his particular line of automobiles or his particular line of food or other products. Yet that's what's happening now with the telecommunications companies. It is as obnoxious and as rude as that. The telecommunication companies and computer software corporations are basically selling the kids their products in the classroom under the rubric of public education, where there is supposed to be winnowing and sifting, and there is supposed to be a deliberation about the idyllic society of tomorrow or a preferred educational or government or social system where we really vulgarize the classroom and turn it into a commercial. I see that as going a long, long ways away from just mere business people having an interest in education.
But as companies like Ameritech have discovered, the potential for profits is enormous. Todd Price cites the case of one school district that turned to Ameritech because of an already bleak financial situation.
This was an Ameritech super school site where there was a lot of press attention to it. There were heavy stakes players like the governor and various school administrators and politicians that were using this one site in Appalachia. It's called Coal Grove and Ironton. These are like amazing names. It's a perfect novel because these are the industrial sites that are destroyed now and that have a lot of generations of coal miners, sons and daughters, that are remaining destitute and poor throughout this information superhighway. And in lieu of getting more funds and resources and a poverty program that will help these folks out, what they suggested was we'll give them information technology, computers and networks and video distance learning. They'd put on lavish shows for other legislators, and they'd be like, this is wonderful. Well, the network never really fully developed, and the content providers never really came through. And indeed, a lot of schools were like, well, what do we really want to go to Appalachia for? How could this enhance our curriculum? And it's a poverty-stricken area, and the story is real tragedy because it's just another example of how the impoverished are ironically used to boost the profits of major corporations like Ameritech that have, like, you know, when I said this was going to boost their profits back in 94, I had no idea that it would mean, like, $50 billion, you know. I mean, I thought, like, you know, yes, this is a greedy corporation. All corporations are greedy. But basically, I had no idea, to what length this would mean. And this is a fairly, you know, friendly corporation. They have friendly CEOs, friendly people. They're like Disney. They aren't brutal-sounding people, but they just enrich themselves beyond our wildest dreams.
As Todd Price described, most technology-based sharing arrangements between for-profit corporations and non-profit schools are anything but symbiotic. Ameritech Super School is only the latest example of school system profiteering, and it will certainly not be the last. But for the majority of public schools, the cost of educating children is still subsidized primarily by taxpayers in the form of local property tax. Consequently, districts with high property value generally have more money to spend than less developed areas. In 1997, the Vermont State Legislature passed a measure that attempted to eliminate financial disparity between school districts. The Equal Educational Opportunity Act, or Act 60 as it was known, introduced a completely new concept for supplementing the budgets of struggling districts by making schools codependent on a statewide property tax. Representative Val Vinson is chair of the House Education Committee in the Vermont State Legislature. She helped to mastermind Act 60 in 1997.
What has happened in Vermont since, I would say, the 1950s, when the state decided, the General Assembly decided, that some mountains could be developed for ski areas? So from 1950 until the 90s, a few communities in Vermont that hosted ski resorts were becoming very, very property wealthy. And they were able to, with very little tax effort, spend $9,000 to $10,000 a year per pupil, where their neighboring towns, and I live in Waterbury, right next door to Stowe, which is a international ski resort, quite a beautiful community. In my community, we were able to spend 2/3 of the amount per pupil that in Stowe they were able to spend, and our tax rate or tax burden, however you want to look at it, was twice as high. So these inequities were neighbor to neighbor based on a line that divided the town.
To better understand just how Act 60 has impacted communities in Vermont, we spoke with Jules Older, a writer and resident of Albany, Vermont. Jules, I'm interested in your viewpoint on, the mechanics of Act 60. I understand it was signed into law already over 2 years ago in June of 1997, but could you explain just briefly what Act 60 does in terms of, changing tax rates and changing the per capita school spending in Vermont school districts?
Act 60 makes all Vermonters responsible for all the children in Vermont, at least their schooling. So that if a town has the blessing of a great mountain or a wonderful lake or a terrific brand new factory, and people have to pay very little in the way of property taxes there, they help subsidize towns like the one I live in, which has neither factory nor mountain nor lake, just a bunch of poor people trying to get their kids a decent education. It's kind of in keeping with the notion I know you've heard, it takes a village. If you look at Vermont as a village of about 500,000, this is the village that takes care of the education of Vermont's kids.
What problems have arisen in Vermont since Act 60 came around?
There's been a great hue and cry from what's been come to be known as the gold towns. The gold towns are those that have a lot of inherent wealth, usually because there's a ski mountain next door. So Stowe has led the charge, although others are very much involved in it, and they have done everything that they could to subvert it and to raise anti-Act 60 feelings in the legislature among the people. And I don't think they're succeeding at it. I think, in fact, the League of Cities and Towns, which is very much opposed to it, although most of the towns in Vermont benefit from it, has actually backed off from its strident anti-Act 60 position.
So what we're seeing here is really the small percentage of towns that have a lot of money are causing a big fuss about having to subsidize basically the rest of Vermont. Is that the case?
Yeah. The extreme actually is a small town in which Stratton Mountain is located, which they claim, and I have no reason to doubt it, that their rates were going to go up 700%. Well, that's pretty striking, except that they were paying something like a nickel for their rates, and other towns were paying over $1.50. So that 700% doesn't sound so awesome in that context. But they went to the extreme of setting up a private school and closing their public school. Now, the private school is having a great deal of trouble, with some in the community supporting it vigorously and some opposing it just as vigorously. And many of those who oppose it were those who supported it in the beginning. One of the issues is, now that it's a private school, they can turn down students much more easily than a public school. So they are not taken care of, so it was alleged by the upset parents of the town, the students who are less desirable, those who are harder to educate, those who have special needs, those who public schools have to educate. What is kind of galling about this is that this school, although it's a private school, is largely supported by tax dollars. So I feel like it's once again the poor supporting the rich.
Do you think things like Act 60, you know, legislated, you know, redistribution of the wealth, if that were to be applied on a wider scale, say, you know, in a majority of states in the country, would that have an effect as far as, you know, reducing maybe the educational opportunity gaps, the career opportunity gaps between rich and poor?
Oh, I think the problem is stratification now. We're becoming a very, very stratified country with enormous numbers of very rich and a fair swag of very poor with a huge, huge gap between them. I don't think that's a good idea for a country. It's not really redistribution of the wealth that we're talking about. It's redistribution of educational wealth. And I think that anything that helps it along is all to the good. It is happening around the country. It's happening in many states. It's usually happening through the courts, as it did in Vermont. The legislature never got the cojones to take care of this bad piece of Vermont, but the court did, and the court said no, you got to straighten this out. It's going on in New Hampshire now as well, and there's a big fight there, and it's going on in many states around the country.
So how's it in these smaller towns? Are they, you know, sitting fat and happy with their big extra paycheck? Is this money, you know, being well spent now?
It is. You never see dancing in the streets here. I live in one of these towns, and we have a new school, which came before Act 60, by the way. The citizens of this town really bit the bullet and said, the state had said, your school is in such bad shape that we're either going to close it or you're going to build a new one. And they decided to bite the bullet and build a new one. They built a really fine new school, and they've staffed it, and they've paid for it. And I don't mean that it goes through every year without a fight when the school budget comes up. There's always a fight in small towns and big about school budget, but it always passes. And it's definitely a better educational system here than when we had very rickety tinderbox schools. We have a nice place now. And Act 60, no doubt, helps pay for it, eases the burden on the poor, the elderly, the working folks of this area. That's great. I'm all for it. And I was just in Morrisville, which is a bigger town. I live in a little village. Morrisville is an actual town. And their old high school, where I did a little teaching last month, was really in terrible shape. They've managed to spruce it up very nicely, and it's all with Act 60 money. It's been made possible with that cash inflow. How can that be a bad thing?
But when we raised that question to a spokesperson for the Anti-Act 60 Committee in Stowe, Vermont, he declined to comment. And undoubtedly, not all Vermonters support Act 60. Nevertheless, Representative Vincent confidently claims that the measure is working across the board. She says that while property-rich towns such as Stowe may be losing funding for existing programs, so far their students haven't suffered.
But for the last 2 days, assessment results have been on the front page of our Burlington Free Press, talking about two schools in particular in Chittenden County, our urban area in Vermont. One town, a property-rich town, South Burlington, had very high scores in math, in the math assessment, and they have tested better than anywhere in the state. There's a little concern that they have difficulty maintaining all their services, but the other end of the spectrum for a school that tested very well, their scores, they didn't have as many students passing the assessment, but what they had shown was tremendous gain in the last 2 years, and the superintendent there said it was based on having more money for professional development for teachers, finally having money for new textbooks. They had invested $70,000 in a small school district, and adding a math teacher in sixth grade. So the revenues that had hurt South Burlington, but they were still able to maintain the highest test scores, really helped Winooski, which probably has demographics that show the lowest economic status in the county and a very high population of students that move in and move out. So they have a very difficult population to work with in terms of students, and they have progressed dramatically in 2 years, and it was announced by their superintendent that it was due to the money that became available to Winooski through the Act 60 financing mechanism.
So while Act 60 is still a controversial topic in Vermont 2 years after its implementation, its positive effects are taking root, and the goal of increased educational opportunity appears to be at least partly achieved. That's all for this edition of Bruderhof Radio. I'm your host and producer, Andrew Zimmerman. Ben Wright helped to write and produce this program, and thanks to David Goodman and Mother Jones Magazine for information on Act 60 in Vermont.
We'd like to thank Mike Thornton of KVMR in Nevada City, California, and Bruderhof Radio for their contributions to this program. The music in today's program was Making Plans for Nigel by XTC. If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
You still catch me napping one day, and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle,